I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Bizarre and flat-out wrong, shameful, a missed opportunity, a pushover, one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. That's how Republican Senators Flake, Sass, Graham, Corker, and McCain describe President Trump's press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday in Helsinki. Former CIA Director John Brennan called it treasonous. The two leaders first met privately with just translators in the room and then took questions from American and Russian reporters. Trump, who wanted this meeting, said a productive dialogue is good for both countries and the world.
But our relationship has never been worse than it is now. However, that changed as of about 4 hours ago. I really believe that. Nothing would be easier politically than to refuse to meet, to refuse to engage, but that would not accomplish anything. As president, I cannot make decisions on foreign policy in a futile effort to appease partisan critics or the media or Democrats who want to do nothing but resist and obstruct.
The response to the AP's Jonathan Lemire's question generated heat. A heated response, especially after Trump's contentious NATO meeting, calling the EU a foe, criticizing Germany's Angela Merkel, insulting the British Prime Minister Theresa May, and the indictment of 12 Russian military intelligence officers on Friday, part of the Mueller investigation. Here's a slightly edited clip.
Just now, President Putin denied having anything to do with the election interference in 2016. Every U.S. intelligence agency has concluded that Russia did. My first question for you, sir, is who do you believe? My second question is, would you now, with the whole world watching, tell President Putin, would you denounce what happened in 2016, and would you warn him to never do it again?
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
Well, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Ruja Sill, professor of political science and the SAS director of the Huntsman Program in International Studies and Business. Ruja Sill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is David Rothkopf. He is the CEO of the Rothkopf Group, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's also the host of Deep State Radio. David Rothkopf, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
David, let me begin with you. President Trump has said these things that he said yesterday before. He has not said them in that particular setting with Vladimir Putin standing next to him. What was his message from the press conference yesterday? What is he telling us?
I think he's telling us a few things. Let me take a step back because I think you're right. He has said this before. So what makes it different? Well, one thing that makes it different is that on Friday, Robert Mueller determined that it was a good idea to, at that point, file an indictment against 12 members of the Russian Military Intelligence Unit, GRU, name them, and explain what they were doing to undermine the election. So Mueller, who has had this information for a while, made a decision that Friday, prior to Trump going to meet with Putin, he needed to say, look, this is a national security issue. It is serious. It is not a 400-pound hacker in the basement. It is the Russian military, which, by the way, means in all likelihood that it was approved by Vladimir Putin, given the nature of the target. And at the same time, not a coincidence, I think, Dan Coats, former Republican senator from Indiana, director of national intelligence, came out and said, look, this is an ongoing attack. So Trump has denied things in the past, but you had this sort of very loud reiteration that this is serious, it's national security, it's the Russian military, coming from the intelligence community and Mueller. Then Trump takes that information, and instead of presenting it to Putin or, you know, creating some kind of a fig leaf like he raised it with Putin or challenging Putin or creating sanctions or canceling the meeting, he stood next to Putin and said, no, I believe Putin. I don't believe the intelligence community. I don't believe the national security community of the United States. And that's just something that's never happened before. This was the president of the United States essentially saying, I am more aligned with the president of the Russian Federation than I am with my military, my law enforcement community, my intelligence community.
And you're saying, David Rothkopf, that's the essential message that you took away from yesterday. How about from you, Rudy? How did you see that press conference?
Well, the press conference, it's hard to disagree with what David just said. We saw it all. This is a president of the United States standing next to the president of Russia. Relations are at an all-time low. And we have a president taking sides in a rather non-subtle way. No qualifications, no delaying. So at least tactically, it was a blunder. I think in terms of, you know, strong words being used like treason, that might be a little bit beyond the pale, and maybe that's a little bit politicized in the present moment. But if we do take a step back and think about the hours that were spent before that press conference, I'm just wondering what kind of additional information will come out. There were some hints. There were some hints about disagreements in Crimea. There were some hints about the coming competition on oil and gas between Nord Stream 2 and what U.S. shale and LNG would do. And there were some very interesting hints about what role Russia might play in restraining Iran and Syria and how that might benefit Israeli security. Those are a number of things that just are not getting any kind of play right now.
Because they're hints, you think?
I think there were actual
discussions.
And were
they coming from the national security team?
I don't think these are policies that are particularly controversial. I mean, especially in the oil and gas, he's representing U.S. competitive, you know, oil and gas industry. So there's no reason to think that is coming from being in Putin's pocket. Certainly the Israel, Syria, Iran situation is something that Israel is very happy with. So I think these are not things that are controversial. But the problem is, if these are positive takeaways, we are not finding out about them, partly because of Trump's own blunders, standing there and taking sides on the most critical political issue in the U.S. He cannot represent this country adequately if the vast majority of the opposition and even a strong group within his own party question his ability to independently make choices. He hurt his own agenda.
Well, David, let me go back to you. And I quoted former CIA Director John Brennan. He called what happened yesterday treasonous. Do you see it that way?
Yes. And I don't think it's overstatement, and I don't think it's political. Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution defines that kind of activity by saying that treason is adhering to an enemy or providing them aid and comfort. This is not a gray area. The Russian military has been engaged in an ongoing attack, not just, by the way, on the United States, but on Western democracies, see Brexit, see France, see Germany, see Italy, see Central European democracies. They are seeking to change outcomes in democratic elections, weaken democratic societies, and do all the things that an enemy does to undermine an adversary. They are the enemy. And Donald Trump, by denying that they did it, by distracting from them doing it, by supporting them and saying they're telling the truth when it's clear that they are not, is clearly providing aid and comfort to the enemy. And when we allow this to be treated as business as usual, or when we say this is just a political issue, we minimize the fact that something extraordinary is happening. For the first time in the history of the United States, you have a president of the United States siding with an adversary against the U.S. national security establishment, against the interests of the people of the United States. And frankly, he's done it so many times now, for so long now, that no one can trust that this man will actually act on behalf of the people who elected him.
Well, Rudy, let me go back to you and not to put too many words here, but he described Russia as a competitor. He described it as wasn't first on his list of foes, but it was, I think, second or third on his list of foes. Is Russia, is Putin, are they our enemy?
As an analyst, I would say they are an adversary, and adversaries become enemies. Then they become partners, and they become selective players who are sitting across the table from us. Vladimir Putin said the Cold War is over, but in one respect it's not, which is that there is complexity in the world of international politics. There's complexity in the world of diplomacy. That complexity was on full display in the Cold War when we had two systems ideologically committed to the destruction of the other with nuclear weapons, getting to the edge of the Cuban Missile Crisis. If leaders of those two countries can sit down and start discussing, enemies can at least have peaceful coexistence, as Nikita Khrushchev once put it. So in that sense, we don't really have to label Russia. When Russia does things that are against our interests, we push back. When we do things against their interests, they push back. This is politics. I have to see this as an analyst, you know, not sort of caught up in the moment of Trump, but a long-term relationship between the U.S. and Russia that goes back decades, includes the Cold War, and will continue long after Trump and Putin are gone. And we better understand, you know, what the breadth and complexity of that society and also their sense of what role they want to play in geopolitics, which is not simply a matter of, you know, undermining Western democracies. They are trying to get their agenda across, mm-hmm. but so are we. And this is the world of international politics.
Well,
you'll forgive me, but
I'm a
historian of national security, and I am an analyst. And I think that sometimes you have to label people. And I think that it is, in fact, the national security imperative of the United States to identify countries as adversaries or as enemies when they are behaving that way. If the Russian government was and is involved in an effort to undermine the most fundamental aspect of American society, that is our democratic institutions, put their people in place, sow dissension within the United States, division on racial lines and other lines, as they were proven to do in this case, or as they've been proven to do, push the UK out of the EU, as they have done by putting their thumb on the scale of Brexit, and also violating international norms by seizing Crimea, invading the Ukraine. Today is the fourth anniversary of the shootdown of a plane carrying 300 innocent individuals by Ukrainian separatists with the support of the Russian government, entering into Syria, seeking to impose their view in support of Bashar al-Assad, who is one of the world's most brutal, murderous dictators, and against the interests of the United States. Yeah, sure, we could use the language of saying we must have some common interests with them, because we do. But what we have never had before is an adversary so dedicated to undermining us, who has had as their principal ally in the United States, against the judgment of all of his advisors, the President of the United States. And that makes this extraordinary, and that makes tiptoeing around it or using measured analytical language a mistake. Sometimes we have to turn on the red flashing light and say, this is a different moment.
Well, we have to take a very short break. I'm sure both of our guests have much more to say, and our listeners as well. That's David Rothkopf. Also with us, Rudra Sill. We are talking about Russia-U.S. relations in light of yesterday's press conference, in light of the long history between these two countries. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Many ways to join our conversation here on Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just quickly reintroduce our two guests, Rudra Sill, Rudy Sill, professor of political science, and the SAS director of the Huntsman Program in International Studies and Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He's with us here in our Philadelphia studio. David Rothkopf joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., CEO of the Rothkopf Group, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, I should say, and host of Deep State Radio. Let me read some comments. Email from Stu, the one thing a bully is afraid of is a bigger bully. Facebook comment from Linda, it's not about Trump doing better. He can't do better. He's a traitor to this country and, at the very least, an incompetent leader. The time to impeach is now. A Facebook comment from Carl, this is what we get when we allow a complete and utter moron to occupy the White House. He's a con man, and they go on from there. Let me go back to you, Rudy, and I've heard several times President Reagan saying, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, where he really directly confronted Russia and its leadership. And I think you know, it was a different time, a different world in many ways. But nonetheless, he directly confronted the head of Russia. We did not see that yesterday.
No, we definitely did not see that yesterday. And when Reagan was confronting Gorbachev, of course, the Republicans do like to make a big statement about Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. But, you know, those of us who were paying more closer attention know that it wasn't Reagan telling Gorbachev to tear down the wall, and that's how it happened. It was a much more complicated story. But the interesting parallel there might actually be the reverse side. Gorbachev was going there to offer concessions. Gorbachev was going there to break away from decades of Soviet doctrine. He was breaking with his military in many areas, and he paid the price later on in the military coup that was organized against him by their intelligence services. So he was the one who was taking the risks. But I think one big difference is Gorbachev was still measured in the way he approached it. And I'm, you know, this is an interesting comparison I'm drawing between the way Trump is approaching something that he's very unpopular about and Gorbachev. Gorbachev did his homework. Gorbachev was much more measured. Gorbachev was much more clever about bringing in theories and building at least a stable coalition of people who had a common, coherent view of the world or a new world that they were trying to move into. You don't see any of that here. What you're seeing here is a litany of darts being thrown. Yes, you know, EU is a foe. I mean, I'm not a fan of this type of leadership at all. What I'm hoping is that we can extricate the U.S.-Russian relationship from the Trumpism and the reactions against Trump as the, you know, utter moron or traitor or whatever have you, and recognize that perhaps two gigantic nuclear powers should at least have some back channels of communication open, at least prevent worse things from happening. These are not just ordinary enemies. These are adversaries that can at least contain things that we saw in Syria in the deconfliction there. So there are areas of mutual interest where progress can be made if, in fact, it can happen. My only anxiety is that I think things like summits draw so much attention. And this is something where maybe – you know, separate task force could have actually made progress more quietly without making this such a big spectacle. And the spectacle really has so far seemed to backfire unless a new narrative starts to emerge with more details. I'm curious to know what, you know, for example, Pompeo spoke with Lavrov about, because here are two seasoned veterans. Was there something else that was said there? I'd like to know that.
Well, and let me go back to you, David, but just to say this was a meeting that the President Trump wanted and has really worked for. David, you described how you see the relationship between the United States and Russia. So what should we do about this? And I ask that knowing that there are sanctions that have been put in place that were also apparently arming people that I guess we consider to be our allies in Ukraine, something I believe President Obama didn't want to do. But then what? How do we go ahead? How do we move forward on this relationship, if anything?
Well, I think we need to move forward on the relationship, and certainly what was just said makes sense. I think that where you have any kind of relationship, you want to identify common areas, and there's certain things that we could still hope to achieve out of the Russian relationship, even in the near term, including arms reductions, including some kind of engagement around the issue of Syria, some kind of engagement around the issue of Ukraine, some kind of engagement around the issue of energy supplies. And so I think those things should be pursued. What I'm concerned about, of course, is that some of the talk about the ideas discussed in Syria have the U.S. pulling out of Syria and letting the Russians sort of take further control there in exchange, and I put that in air quotes, for having the Iranians move away from the Israeli border. This appears to help the Israelis. What it really does is it helps Assad and it helps the Russians. And, of course, the Russians don't really have the ability to keep the Iranians out if that's what they if the Iranians don't want to go along with it. And similarly, I think there are a number of other areas in this relationship where dialogue would be a good thing if it was a fair dialogue and there was somebody on our side representing U.S. interests. But if it means, as has been discussed by Trump, pulling troops out of Germany, or if it means cutting back on exercises, that sends the wrong message to Russia. So I think we need a balance. We need to say we will challenge you on these cyber issues. We will sanction you on these cyber issues. We will challenge you on your aggression. We will force you by every means available to us to respect international law. And when you play by the rules of a big international player, we'll be willing to have a conversation about other things.
This is a very speculative question, but I think it hangs over our trying to understand why candidate President Trump refuses to criticize Putin and really refuses to say anything negative about Russia. Now, some people say he has something to hide. Some people say it's because he has anxiety about his legitimacy as the president of the United States. Some people have said it's stubbornness. People say it's narcissism. All of that is speculative. David, if I can toss that quickly back to you and Rudy, just be curious about what you make of something that we really don't know, at least as of yet, the answer to.
Well, I think you answered the question. We don't know. It is speculative. He has shown a desire to be involved with the Russians since the 80s. He has shown a desire to meet with Putin for years. His family has apparently done a lot of financial business with the Russians. He has a lot of ties there. He has done business there. He has had people seeking deals on behalf of his company there as late as 2016, possibly later than that. And so that suggests an affinity on his part and aspirations and a kind of a worldview, because he has also, since the 1980s, suggested that our NATO allies were free riders and so forth. So could be worldview, could be self-interest, could be the fact that he ties the Russia debate to his own legitimacy as a president, could be orneriness, contrariness, or it could be that there is some compromise out there on him. You don't need compromise. You know, my last point on this is, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, well, there must be this P tape out there or something like that. The reality is what we saw on videotape yesterday from Helsinki is far more damning than anything that might involve a couple of prostitutes in a hotel room in Russia.
Go ahead, Rudy.
Well, it's hard to disagree with any of that. I mean, those are all legitimate possibilities. And certainly, I think David is absolutely right in pointing out that the way in which the spectacle played out in Helsinki really kind of hurt Trump's own agenda. Again, I will leave the door open to more information coming out of the actual closed-door meeting and the context between the Secretaries of State and Foreign Minister Lavrov. So maybe, you know, we can see how the narrative evolves, maybe at least gets a little bit more nuanced. But, you know, that may not happen. This might be really what we're looking at. And so, you know, if I have to try to psychoanalyze Trump, which is really not my forte, I would say that there's a hint of narcissism. You could see it in some of the statements he made about, you know, there were great times and Americans had to put, you know, that whole diplomacy. And so he was trying to be the great statesman and you know, imagine himself to be Reagan next to Gorbachev or Gorbachev next to Reagan. I don't know. So there's an element of that. And there's also, he's always on every issue been sort of tried to shock people. He's shocked people in China. We're going to have a trade war with China, a wall against Mexico. EU's our foe. I mean, he seems to benefit from shocking people. And it's a tactic that he thinks works, at least insofar as it worked when he was a candidate. It helped rally the base. It helped show him as someone who doesn't care about what the mainstream media says. And his base responds to that and uses the term mainstream media regularly. And I think he's carried that over as a president, and that's dangerous, because I think when you're governing, you have to find allies, you have to build coalitions, and you have to do that in a subtle way. You have to do it with members of your own party first, and at least keep them in line. But from what I'm seeing, he's actually losing even more support within his own party right now. So he is not really helping his own cause insofar as he wants to go down in history as some great statesman who got us out of this low point in U.S.-Russia relations.
That's Rudy Sill, Rudra Sill from the University of Pennsylvania, David Rothkopf joining us as well, and from the Rothkopf Group. And we are talking about the U.S.-Russia relationship in light of yesterday's news conference or press conference. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm looking at my screen here, lots of talk about bullies and treason and cyber warfare and a lot of very angry and I think concerned people as well. Let's talk about Vladimir Putin. What did this conference, this meeting do for him? Rudy, if I can toss that quickly to you and then to you, David.
Sure. I think there's two answers to that. Domestically, I don't think it did as much as we think. We'd like to, you know, most of our news reports are saying this is a big win for Putin. He certainly looked, you know, very poised, and but he's done that in front of his domestic audiences over and over. His four-hour, you know, direct line question and answer session. He actually shows a good command of detail, almost reminiscent of Bill Clinton in terms of how many pieces of information he can throw out there. Doesn't make him a great leader, or a good leader, or a friend. It just means that domestically he does his homework. And even yesterday, he had a pencil and notepad at the press conference to make notes, whereas Trump was going off, you know, whatever came into his mind. But domestically, I don't think this has helped Putin, because the biggest issue right now in Russia is this policy over raising the pension age, and that is going to have some blowback, and nothing, not the World Cup, not this press conference, will reduce that fall for now. It is something Russia has to do. Putin has had to do unpopular things from the moment he took office, the labor code, the tax code. These are things that were not popular, monetizing utilities that were free, and these all led to protests. These all led to periods where there was a decline. But you look at most industrial, post-industrial countries, this is something they have to do. So domestically, I don't think this did much for him. Internationally, he got to stand next to Trump as one of two major powers. And this is something, you know, that hasn't happened since the Soviet Union fell. I don't think Putin is under any illusions that Russia is anywhere near the competitor the Soviet Union was. He has said over and over, we cannot match the United States. Indeed, much of what we're seeing from Russia is sort of, you know, Obama said it's the behavior of a weak power. I don't know about weak, but certainly a country that has become weak and is trying to find a way to become more relevant. And so this was very good in terms of having the stage and showing that he's a businesslike professional. And certainly next to Trump, he looks even more that way.
Well, David, let me put that to you, but also frame it slightly differently, especially on the heels of the NATO summit of the week before. And of course, all the things that he has said about Angela Merkel and Theresa May. Do you think Putin feels emboldened? And if he does, what would that mean?
Jeez. You know, the thought of Putin more emboldened is a little bit unnerving. Mm. You know, when you think back that he went into Georgia, he went into Crimea, he's gone into Syria, he's shot down planes, he's murdering people in the United Kingdom. He is intervening in the election processes of Western governments, funding groups in the West that he thinks will serve his purposes, including, we had another arrest in this broader case yesterday of a woman who is a Russian spy who implanted herself within the world of the NRA and served as a conduit, apparently, for seeking Russian influence in the United States via the National Rifle Association. So, you know, this guy doesn't need to be emboldened. He's pretty bold. And I think one of the things that, you know, has raised his standing on the world stage is he's getting away with most of it. And by the way, as bad as Trump's performance was yesterday, he's not the only American president who's left the door open for Putin to gain this way. Barack Obama did not challenge Putin in the ways that he could have or should have with regard to Ukraine, did not stand up to him or sound the alarms, I think, in the ways that he could have during the interventions in the 2016 campaign. Even George Bush was fairly limited in his responses to the intervention in Georgia. So Putin is gaining stature because he is taking chances and getting away with it, and American presidents are letting him getting away with it. What's different about Trump is that he's kind of actively helping him to get away with it and seems to be on Putin's side.
Well, where does this leave then Republicans? I quoted from some of them. It should be said that most of who I quoted from are not going to be in Congress too much longer. And also, David, let me toss this first back to you. Where does that leave Pompeo and members of the president's national security team?
I don't know. I think they must have some long, dark nights of the soul going on because, you know, these are people who have traditionally been in their careers more hawkish on Russia, more defensive, you know, for a strong defense of the United States. And the direction Trump has taken the party with regard to these issues is antithetical to any place the Republican Party has ever been. You don't have to go that far back to remembering Mitt Romney lecturing Barack Obama on the threat posed by Russia. Mm-hmm. And Trump's in a completely different place. I think there is a very serious issue that is got to be weighing in the minds of people like Dan Coats, who yesterday, after Trump's statement, issued his own statement saying, no, we meant it, you know, without running it by the White House. And I think you're starting to get to the point where there is likely to be more pushback. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if over the course of the next couple of weeks or months, you start to see resignations within the Trump administration because this has been a bridge too far. Trump has clearly thrown down in the wrong direction, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if some of these people depart. And candidly, I think they should.
Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats said, and I'll just quote a sentence here, we've been clear in our assessments of Russian meddling in the 2016 election and their ongoing pervasive efforts to undermine our democracy, and we will continue to provide unvarnished and objective intelligence in support of our national security. Rudy, about a minute or so before we have to take another break, and certainly this is something that Mueller and others are looking into, whether there was, certainly Russia wanted to and was able to infiltrate some of our election system. The question is whether there was collusion or not on the part of members of the Trump team. Where do you think this leads people like Dan Coats and others?
Well, I think at the end of the day, you're going to have to deal with the practical question of now what? There is the question of accountability looking backwards. But time is ticking away. We have to think about ways to prevent worse things from happening. Hacking tools are getting more and more sophisticated. I should mention that much of what we're seeing from the Russians is joining a club. There's been a group of people, the U.S. leading among them, the Chinese, the Israelis. There are people who have been working on cyber warfare for quite some time. And our own cyber command is by far the most well-resourced and most effective. And they themselves have been very clear that their tools are not merely defensive. Yeah. This has been on public record from Keith Anderson. So in that environment, did the Russians try to send signals that we have tools? Putin has time and again said, you know, we need to have some discussion about cyber warfare, because I think they are, again, in a weak position. So much of this is trying to get some sort of an agreement. And honestly, I believe that we are sort of in a new era in the same way that we were in the nuclear age in the early 60s, that it was a new technology, it was a new set of threats, a new worry about deterrence, and it required some talking. And I think cyber warfare is in that new realm.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We're going to take a short break and get back to our conversation with Ruja Sill and David Rothkopf. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ruja Sill from the University of Pennsylvania and David Rothkopf, CEO of the Rothkopf Group, about yesterday's press conference and the relationship between the United States and Russia. Let me play another clip from yesterday's press conference. Again, President Trump answering questions about Vladimir Putin.
I think that the United States has been foolish. I think we've all been foolish. We should have had this dialogue a long time ago, a long time, frankly, before I got to office. And I think we're all to blame. I think that the United States now has stepped forward along with Russia, and we're getting together, and we have a chance to do some great things, whether it's nuclear proliferation in terms of stopping, because we have to do it. Ultimately, that's probably the most important thing that we can be working on. But I do feel that we have both made some mistakes. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all.
So many things in there. Well, let me pick up on the probe comment, David. If I come back to you, basically saying the probe is a problem for this country. Saying that next to Vladimir Putin, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, it used to be that presidents did not go overseas, members of the U.S. government did not go overseas and bring our political dirty linen with us. And I think he's clearly doing that. But, you know, beyond that, the evidence produced by this investigation so far, which is 30-plus indictments or guilty pleas, 200-plus charges, suggests that there is a there and that it's really substantial. And the consequence of that investigation dovetails with the conclusions of every single intelligence agency that Russia attacked us. And therefore, what the president should have been doing based on all of this is challenging Putin on it and saying, look, we are now giving you names of the people involved. We are deep inside your systems. We have great capabilities. We can stop you. We will stop you. And if you do this again, if you continue to do this, you are going to pay a big price, and be very specific about what that price was. Instead, as you know, Trump is wont to do, it's all about him. Rudy, a moment ago, said that there was a hint of narcissism with Trump. This is the one area where Trump's personality lives up to his beloved adjectives. His narcissism is huge. It is gigantic. This guy thinks of nothing except in terms of himself. Jeff Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, did an article a while back in which he talked about the Trump doctrine. There is no Trump doctrine. He doesn't have a strategic bone in his body. Everything is what's in it for me. And when he says that this probe, as he refers to it, is damaging, it's not damaging to the U.S.-Russia relationship. The Russians did this stuff. The U.S. should be pushing back. It's damaging to Trump. And everything he says is about Trump.
Rudy, let me ask you about the first part of that comment from President Trump, which is looking at this relationship between the United States and Russia. And he says, well, we all bear some blame or responsibility for where we are. Do you agree?
Yeah. Well, as an analyst, you look back at any conflict throughout history and you find that there's going to be, in many cases, you know, some actions that have reactions. And this is a story where I think our administrations change fairly frequently and the people that are in the Beltway change frequently. And so they may be looking at a shorter time frame, whereas in Moscow, I think there's a much longer time frame in terms of when they go back and look at things that were done. The 1990s, for example, is for us a decade where we almost got Russia to join the civilized Western world. And then everything after that was, oh, no, Putin took it all away. Whereas in Russia, the 1990s is a time of disaster, a time of weakness, a time of economic catastrophe, a time of massive unemployment and people watching their real incomes shrivel. And so it isn't a time that people remember fondly, and they do associate that with American advisors. American advisors, incidentally, who took public claim for helping Yeltsin get elected in 1996. And they point that out. And we can say that that's just grandstanding and, you know, trying to obfuscate. Maybe it is. But it's also a fact. And so does that fact matter to us? Maybe not. Does it matter to in Moscow? I think it does. And so there are – and NATO expansion is something that we have had our own internal healthy debate over whether it was a good idea way back in the early 90s. And there were two legitimate sides to that debate. And I think that debate is hard to have now because of the way Trump has behaved. Mm-hmm. So I am with David in terms of the things that Trump is doing is not really helping the situation the way that Trump, the grand statesman, wants to imagine himself. He is in it for himself, but I don't think it's necessarily for the money. This time around, I think it is about trying to etch his name as one of the great leaders, and I don't think he realizes what that really takes.
Let me read. We got a lot of comments here. One from here's an email. Wouldn't it have been with a question? Wouldn't it have been bad diplomacy to call Putin a liar on stage next to him in front of the whole world? David, I'm going to toss that to you. Would that have been bad diplomacy to do that in that setting?
Well, look, I mean, diplomacy is about how you frame it. It's not about the substance of what you say. Would it have been a good message for the President of the United States to stand up next to President Putin, much as France's President Macron did, and say, we know what you did. We don't accept your denials. We are going to stop you from being effective in this regard. Let's not play games. And if you do more of this, we are going to come back at you hard. Would that have been undiplomatic? No, that's the purpose of diplomacy, is to advance U.S. interests. Does he have to say, you know, you're a liar? Well, you know,
there are ways to say
there are ways to say it, simply, you know, in much the same way that Putin says it about the U.S. intelligence community. He says these are fabricated stories, and he dismisses them all the time. In fact, both he and Trump said the intelligence community was a liar yesterday. So in that respect, I have to say, perhaps this comment is misdirected, and perhaps we ought to be more concerned about who Trump is calling a liar rather than, whether or not he's using that kind of language.
Let me read some more email comments. One from Claudia. I honestly believe that if we could see Trump's tax returns, we would see that he's being paid by the Russian government, and that's why he denies U.S. voters access. I believe that he has been a Russian asset for years. An email from Bryn. Trump needs the world to believe he single-handedly won the presidency with no external help. A comment from Andrew. If warfare includes cyber warfare, then it fits the definition of treason to a T. Are we in, picking on what you had said earlier, Rudy, are we in Cold War cyber warfare? I don't even know what to call it.
Well, it depends on how you define the Cold War. If we think of the Cold War as a battle between two systems, two ideologies, I don't think the ideological differences are that coherent on either side, but certainly not on the Russian side. It's much more state-centric, not about communism versus mm-hmm. capitalism. So in that sense, it's not a Cold War situation. But in terms of new technologies changing the turf of politics, mm-hmm. international and domestic, I mean, our domestic politics has changed as well in terms of the degrees of polarization we're seeing with social media, the way in which information is circulating, the comments you're reading are from your WHYY listener base we might identify with, and yet I'm sure that there are other streams of comments going on elsewhere. So social media has really kind of created barriers, and maybe we can say one side is absolutely right, one side is absolutely wrong, but it has changed the nature of politics, and I think it's changed the nature of international politics. President Obama indicted 5 Chinese officials in 2014 who were involved in hacking and industrial espionage. This is a new world that we're in, and the U.S. was the leader in it, is the leader in it. If we get into a head-to-head with Russia, there's no question in my mind who would win. So the question is to use that advantage and maybe set some rules in play. And I think this is not something Vladimir Putin is opposed to. He did not just hack us for the sake of hacking us if, in fact, there was an explicit order from the Kremlin, which I don't know. I'm sure he wanted to send the message that we have these tools, we can do, mess around with you. But he's saying it as a reaction in his head, at least, that this is in response to things that have been going on. And the question is, can we move forward if we blame him and call him a liar in public? That makes it very hard. Mm. So the real question is, what kind of politician are we? Are we pragmatists who want to think about the future? Do we need to settle accounts first? I personally would prefer to think about the future. I have kids in college. I want them to live in a safer, more sane world.
Me too. But I wonder, David, whether whether no matter what Mueller comes up with, whether Putin or Russia has won, in that we are, as Rudy was referencing, kind of at each other's throats in this country now, and very divided and very much tribal in our response to this whole thing.
Well, I wouldn't lay that at the feet of Vladimir Putin necessarily. Income inequality has been growing in the United States. Yeah. For 40 years. We've had racial divisions in the United States since the beginning of the country. We have seen with the changing of laws regarding broadcast ownership in the late 1980s, this development of this infrastructure of bubbles that Rudy was talking about, where you have worlds in which people, hear completely alternative realities. There is a world out there in which people don't believe in evolution, and they don't believe in history, and they don't believe in math, and they don't believe in the progress of women and the equality of members of society. And there are people out there who are getting support for that day in and day out, oxygen, intellectual oxygen for those kind of views. And by the way our Constitution is set up, it also is giving disproportionate power to the less populated states because of provisions that were made 240 years ago in the United States. And that's only going to grow, by 2030. Something like 8 states will have 50% of the population, but they'll only have 16 senators, and the other 42 states will have 84 senators. It also reflects a difference in the electoral vote. So divisions in a United States society are deep. They are being exploited by Putin. They weren't created by Putin.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet, Nikita Khrushchev said that they would bury us. Trump's bromance with Putin is Russia's shovel. An email from Kyle. What's the end game of what Russia's doing to sow doubt in Western institutions? In fact, let me pick up on this. And if I can put that to you, Rudy, what do you see as the end game? As we're kind of, I'm not sure what inning we're in, but nonetheless, what do you see as the end game?
Well, I got to start with that Khrushchev quote, which was also popularized in the famous Sting song in the 1990s. I'd like to sing it for you, but I'll spare
That's
you.
<okay. laughs>
But that statement was actually completely misconstrued, and it reminds me of another statement Putin made that is also frequently misconstrued. We will bury you was about the two of systems competing, and we will be present at your burial was the meaning of what Khrushchev was saying in Russian, and it was about that we will outlive you. It wasn't a threat to attack. In fact, this was the time Khrushchev was recognizing the dangers of nuclear weapons and invented the phrase peaceful coexistence to capture what he saw as a way of getting along with the adversary, the opposite system. So I think, you know, this is something we have to keep in mind that everything we hear isn't necessarily a long-term plan to destroy everything. Putin has been in power since 2000 as president, since 1999 as prime minister. That's a long time to do a huge amount of damage. But what we're seeing is for a long time, he didn't do any of that. Things started to happen with Georgia around 2008. Then there was a period where things stabilized again. And then we have Ukraine. And so there are like explosive bursts that we're seeing. And if we follow that pattern, we see that this is not someone who for 18 years has been looking for to cause trouble as a bully. There are times he acts like a bully, and there are times when he acts like a businessman. And I think the question for us is to recognize what the conditions are that do it. Is it purely domestic politics in Russia, or are there things globally going on that they're reacting to? And I think we need to talk to people more than Putin and his immediate Kremlin group, because there are other people in Russia who have views on this that are not necessarily just swallowing state propaganda. Some of them are critics of Putin, and even they will have interesting takes on exactly where Russia stands on different global issues.
David, do you think Putin's a killer?
Of course he's a killer. I mean, he's, you know, killing people who oppose him, whether they're in the United Kingdom or they are critics of his. They're members of the media that is operating, under, you know, totalitarian type rules in Russia. And, you know, there's no question about it. That's what he was trained to do in his career as a KGB agent. And that's the way the government operates is, you know, they shot down that plane 4 years ago. Now, it was Russian separatists, and we can discuss how far up the chain of command it went. But it was Vladimir Putin's policies and Vladimir Putin's people who led to that happening, just as they led to absolute ongoing catastrophe in Syria. He has a lot of blood on his hands, and I don't think we should, you know, dress him up or give him the kind of legitimization that he wishes events like yesterday did.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, David, if I can go back to you, and looking at President Trump, what matters most then, what he says or the policies that come out of his administration?
Well, I think that what he says are policies. In foreign policy, what you say affects the standing of the United States, our relationships with our allies, the effectiveness of international institutions, the degree to which people adhere to international norms and laws. So to draw a distinction between the two is to make a mistake.
What do you think, Rudy?
I think there are things that have to be done more quietly, and I think there are times when you don't have to necessarily be explicit publicly about what it is that you're trying to accomplish. I'm hopeful that our own cyber command and people in Russia are maybe now more in conversations with each other to prevent drastic catastrophes, because I do think we have our trigger on things that can affect their public infrastructure just as they do. And I think these are things that can get out of control very fast. So I do hope that what we're seeing in public in the spectacle is not all there is to it. But maybe that's wishful thinking.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Rujasil, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And he's a professor of political science, the SAS director of the Huntsman Program in International Studies and Business at the University of Pennsylvania. David Rothkopf, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And he joined us from the studios of NPR. He is the CEO of the Rothkopf Group, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, host of Deep State Radio. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.